Hi, everybody. It's James Lilacs, and you know it's getting hot in this madcap presidential summer. But we're keeping it cool at Ricochet.com, where it's meaningful and civil. And you can join us for free at Ricochet.com/join. We'll give you a free month to get you started. And after that, a membership is just a few bucks a month, and it's money well spent to stay sane and sharp in this cycle. Ricochet.com/join to get your first 30 days for free.
From PowerlineBlog.com, this is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Meeringhoff, and Stephen Hayward.
Welcome to the Powerline Show. It's Stephen Hayward going rogue again this week with a solo performance. I want to take a look back to Donald Trump's convention acceptance speech a couple of weeks ago. A lot has happened between then and now. But there was one very interesting and significant moment in it, I think, that deserves some wider reflection. If you saw the speech, you might recall a rare moment of humility for Trump when he stopped and thanked the support of evangelical voters for his nomination, adding that he wasn't sure whether he deserved it. Well, one of the surprises of this election season is the fact that Trump did get so much support from evangelical voters, even as he didn't get a lot of support in the primaries from voters who considered themselves to be very conservative. It's an unusual coalition of moderates and evangelicals that helped put him over the top. We'll have more to say about this in a moment, but first I want to pause and mention that we at Powerline are pleased to have a new sponsor for our podcasts. It's The Great Courses, and they're offering a new service through us called The Great Courses Plus. The Great Courses Plus gives you unlimited access to over 7,000 video lectures on your TV, your laptop, your tablet, even your smartphone. Now, one course I've been enjoying lately is called Mr. Lincoln, The Life of Abraham Lincoln, with the great Alan Gelzo, who I think is the preeminent Lincoln scholar in America today. He's written several of the very best books on Lincoln in recent years, and he's got a wonderful voice, and now you can take it in video. His course, The Life of Abraham Lincoln, will take you on a tour of Lincoln's life from his forebears' arrival in America through an evaluation of the ways that Lincoln lives on today. So this course includes lectures on Lincoln as a young man, his early influences, especially the great Whig politician Henry Clay. That's a much neglected theme about Lincoln that I think is quite important myself. Alan talks about Lincoln's understanding of religion and faith. And Alan has a complete book, in fact, on the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858, which he has boiled into a lecture here. Believe me, you don't want to miss out, especially in a political season where true statesmanship like that of Lincoln is conspicuously missing. We all need a good reminder of a model that Lincoln provides, perhaps better than any other figure in American history. And we've got a special offer for listeners of this podcast. Sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet, and you'll immediately get 1 month free to start watching as many lectures as you want. And as I say, you can watch these on any format, TV, tablet, computer, smartphone. So to start your free trial today, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. And we thank The Great Courses Plus for sponsoring the Powerline show. And one of these days, maybe Powerline will get around to doing our own very, very good courses. But for the time being, please use The Great Courses. Now back to our main subject. I mentioned that it was something of a surprise that Donald Trump did so well with evangelical voters in this campaign. Now there's quite a paradox afoot here if you think about it. The line from the conventional media establishment and liberals has been that the Republican Party is enthralled to the religious right. They've been saying this for 20 or perhaps 30 years now, going back to the moral majority in the 1970s and 1980s. On the other hand, if you thought from tabula rasa, what kind of candidate the religious right might put up if they were to design and pick a candidate themselves, Donald Trump, the thrice-married New York playboy billionaire, is the last person you would think they'd ever come up with. And yet that's, in fact, what turned out. Although if you look closely, you find out that evangelicals were somewhat divided about Trump. True, he did get the endorsement of Jerry Falwell Jr., although it's not clear that Jerry Falwell Jr. commands much more than a very famous name. He's not the mass political movement figure that his father was 30 years ago. Meanwhile, Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention was and remains a harsh critic of Trump. Well, I decided that we ought to decode this entire world from a broader perspective with one of the preeminent experts on the evangelical world and relationship of evangelicalism to politics. It's Mike Cromartie of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mike is the most interesting and important person you've never heard of in Washington, D.C., and that's because he's a very rare thing in Washington, D.C. He's actually a modest and humble person that arises from his religious faith. In addition to his deep expertise in Christian theology, he also is the founder of a very important forum that you'll also have never heard of unless you've seen a few press accounts of it. It's a regular meeting called the Faith Angle Forum that brings together leading theologians from all faiths and premier journalists from, you know, the networks, New York Times, places like that, in an effort to help decode what religion is all about for the overwhelmingly secular press corps. On a recent visit to Washington, D.C., I got to sit down with Mike and talk about all of this and many other things. Here's our wide-ranging conversation. Mike Cromartie, thanks for joining us on Powerline. And the reason I've wanted to talk to you on the air like this for a long time is that you're not a lobbyist. You're not a policy wonk or someone who draws up legislation. You don't do cost-benefit analysis. You don't do any of the things a typical Washington person does. Instead, whenever someone gets curious about the religious right, the word goes out in Washington to reporters especially, call Mike Cromartie. So first of all, the religious right is patronized, including by the Republican establishment, as simply a voting bloc to be massaged. And, you know, you take them and understand the religion and politics, I'll put it that way, much more seriously. And so, you know, when you hear the religious right or when a reporter calls you and says the religious right dead, I mean, what's the first thing you tell them? How do you explain yourself? I'll put it that way.
Well, the first thing I say, Steve, is I've been here for 30 years, and I was hired because of the rise of the religious conservative movements in American politics in the late 70s, early 80s. And I was hired specifically to do studies, run conferences, and edit books about them. And now I've been here for over 30 years, and, you know, about every 5 years I get that same phone call, which is, the Christian right is no longer an influence in American life. They're on the wane. They're out. Their death has been pronounced for many years. And the fact of the matter is, while they are no longer the moral majority in American life, they're more like the moral minority, there's still a large constituency of people who identify as religiously conservative on moral, cultural, and theological issues. And they vote. And so any candidate running for president, as we just saw in the Republican primaries, has to pay attention to their existence and has to learn their language, as we saw, for instance, in candidate Donald Trump trying to learn their language. Exactly. And his inability to speak in theological language was really obvious and clear. And so all the candidates that get ready to run, they have concern about foreign policy, economic policy, and other issues. But they're also told you need to learn to speak in a public theological language that resonates with these people. Right. Why? Because they're still there and they still vote. They don't dominate the Republican Party, but they're a huge constituency in the party.
Well, let's go back to the Trump example for a moment because it illustrates an interesting point. Trump's candidacy has divided people on the religious right. You know, Jerry Falwell Jr. endorsed him. I think it's Russell Moore has been a fervent opponent, right?
Exactly.
And the point there is that the religious right is not a monolith. The media is just the religious right in capital letters like it's just one thing. It's more than one thing. There's several different shadings to it. Can you break that down for us a little bit?
Yeah, it's not a monolithic group. I mean, they all hold the same moral, cultural, and religious values when it comes to Judeo-Christian moral ethics. But where they disagree is on prudential judgments about who to vote for and why. And I think we've seen something very deeply disappointing about the leadership of the Christian right in this election by people like Jerry Falwell Jr. and Mike Huckabee and others who have saddled up to Donald Trump and seem to have forgotten all the moral concerns they brought to the public arena years ago and just bracketed them aside while they want someone like Donald Trump to win. It's really been embarrassing. And Dr. Russell Moore has been eloquent and courageous in making it clear that we're going to vote for a candidate that has character. And Donald Trump doesn't exhibit any of these characteristics. He refers to evangelicals as the evangelicals. The evangelicals love me.
Right.
They love me. And so he went down and spoke at Liberty University. And so we've seen we thought the Christian right was evolving and becoming more mature. Some of the leaders that have gotten attention that have endorsed Trump have been really embarrassing.
Yeah.
But here's the truth. Jerry Falwell Jr. is not a leader of the Christian right. The only thing he has going for him is his name. He doesn't have a mailing list. He doesn't have a constituency. He doesn't have a radio program. He does have a school. So when somebody like Jerry Falwell Jr. comes out and does something odd like supporting Donald Trump, well, the media flock there, and they make him bigger than he is. And so what I try to emphasize is that there are no evangelicals across the country saying, I'm waiting to hear what Jerry Falwell Jr. tells me to do, and then I will do it. They don't. They're not self-appointed leaders that they wait for. They don't have a pope or a bishop who says, this is the person we're going to get behind. So they're very independently minded. And so I think at the end of the day, evangelicals may very reluctantly vote for Donald Trump because they despise the Clintons so much. But it's not true to say just because some pastor in First Baptist Church of Dallas makes a, well, I'll be quite candid, a fool of himself by going on Fox News and endorsing somebody like Donald Trump. All these books we wrote about, that we heard about and were written about how important character matters seem to have been forgotten by some of these leaders, and it's very embarrassing.
Now, you are, I think this is accurate to say, it is scientifically demonstrated that you, Mike Cromartie, are the world's greatest networker. At least to a certain
extent. So that's what I hear.
Right. Well, my point is, I know that you talk to religious leaders of all faiths all over the country. What are some of the common things they say to you about Washington or about politics? Are there certain predominant themes that emerge when you talk to people outside the Beltway?
Well, early on in the early days, they thought that, you know, politics is dirty business and they don't like compromise. They come from theological traditions that don't allow compromise. They want to be rigorous in their theology. And they come to Washington, they realize that this is not a conversation among the Southern Baptist Convention. This conversation among a pluralistic society of diverse people, of diverse opinions. And so a lot of religious leaders had to learn the language of the common good and of natural law and what theologically is called common grace. They've had to learn how to work publicly with a public that doesn't agree with them theologically or religiously. And so they've had to learn how to speak and what I like to call a public grammar. And so that's a lesson they've learned, that they've when they come to Washington, you're not speaking to members of your church or to your elders. You're speaking to a larger public of much diversity. And many of them have learned to do that. They borrowed from the tradition of natural law and from the Catholic tradition of natural law, but also the Protestants have an understanding of natural law. And so they've learned to do this better. And not to come in and say it's us versus them like they originally did early on. It's all the good believers against the non-believers. They stopped doing that when they realized that was not very productive. And also they'd stopped doing it because they found a lot of non-believers that they actually agreed with on policy.
Right.
And so that's where they learned this whole subject of natural law and common grace.
It was about, 20 years ago now, I think, or some time ago, that there was the infamous Washington Post news story, if I recall, that said...
1992.
Yeah. You know where I'm going with this.
Poor, uneducated, and easy to command?
Yeah, exactly. Say that again. The Washington Post said...
This constituency is made of people who are poor, uneducated, and easy to command.
Right.
Literally that afternoon, I had a call from the author of the Post piece. He said, I understand you've edited a book on the new Christian right. My colleague told me you have that book, and could I see it? I said, yes, because in the book we have a political demographer who lays out the educational levels, the income levels of these people, and they're not poor, and they all have college degrees and graduate degrees. He said, could you send that book over right away? And so we sent it over, and the next day the Post ran a retraction and an apology for that, because I said, sir, they're not uneducated. Now, they are not easy to command. I know this because I know some of them. But they're not poor and uneducated, and that was a real faux pas on their part.
I didn't realize you'd been in the middle of that, of being the Post to correct that, because that was such an outrageous thing to say in a news story, right? It's one thing for some opinion.
You'd never say it about any other group. I mean, imagine saying Black Lives Matter, these are people who are poor, uneducated, and easy to command. You couldn't say that about LGBT groups. You couldn't say that about any racial group. But they felt okay about saying it about, TV, radio people and TV evangelists.
I don't know why I think this. Was that the precipitating event and leading to you starting the Faith Angle Forum?
Well, that's one of many examples, and the Faith Angle Forum grew out of the idea, Steve, that I would get these phone calls from really intelligent journalists who cover politics, but their questions they asked me were so uninformed about religious America and religious people. And so I would get these questions, and it was like, gosh, this is basic 101 stuff, and you don't know it. So I decided.
But tell me, that when the reporter said, you mentioned Ephesians or Philippians.
Yeah, the Southern Baptists were having a conversation at their national convention about the relationship between men and women in marriage, and it was about male headship, female submission, and what does it all mean. And a journalist from the New York Times called me and said, what is going on with the Southern Baptists? You direct the evangelical studies program there. I said, well, let me begin by saying in the book of Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 and following. And she said, wait, what was that book you just mentioned? Who's the author? Who's the publisher? And I said, oh, I'm sorry. It's a letter. It's a letter from a man named the Apostle Paul. It's the letter to the Ephesians. It's in a book called the New Testament, which follows the Old Testament. And I wasn't being silly because I realized she didn't know. She didn't have any categories for understanding that the Southern Baptists were discussing were certain ways to interpret Paul's letters about how men and women ought to treat each other in marriage. She just didn't have a clue. And so I had to start over like, okay, there's a book. It's called the Bible, and there's a letter called Ephesians. Well, this happened, Steve, maybe half a dozen times of different examples I could go on for an hour about. But I realized, you know, why don't we host some luncheons for journalists and bring in historians and religious scholars and theologians and ethicists and we did, and it was a great success. It got funded by the Pew Foundation, and I went back to Pew, and they said, think bigger. And I said, well, we had four lunches. Why not six? He said, no, think if money were not an object, what would you do? I said, well, first thing I do is I got to call you back. I need to think about that. And I called him back, and I said, what if we took journalists out of Washington, away from New York and Washington, and to a nice venue for 2 days with some of the best scholars we could find on issues at the intersection of religion and public life? And we've done that now for 17 years. And it's invitation only to 20 journalists because we want it to be a good conversation. We make it purposely politically diverse, religiously diverse, gender diverse, ethnically diverse. And we want a conversation not just among one group, but a group of liberals, conservatives, religious, non-religious. And it's been a great success because we get the best thinkers on topics. And so we've talked about what is ISIS, what is the theology of ISIS, the different varieties of Islam. What is an evangelical? What does it mean for politics? What if we had a Mormon become president? We've had two sessions on Mormonism and public life. So we try to connect what's in the news at the intersection of faith and public life with what they're covering. And so it's a real service to them because then they can go back and say, I know now more about Mitt Romney's faith if he becomes president, or I know more now about the theology that motivates ISIS. And so we try to connect it what's in the news, and it really has worked well.
Yeah, I do want you to give me one more dishy story on, just because it's fun and our listeners will enjoy it. Tell a story about the New Republic writer. You don't have to name who it is. It's a person I actually kind of like in a lot of ways.
Yeah, very smart, yeah.
But his long interview with you and his punchline at the end.
Yes, he came to me in the late 80s because Pat Robertson was running for president, and our good friend Fred Barnes of the New Republic at the time said you should go see Cromartie and find out where Pat Robertson's coming from theologically. So we talked about what is an evangelical, what is a fundamentalist, what's a Pentecostal Christian, what's a charismatic Christian, and out of which tradition does Pat Robertson come in? So we talked about that for an hour, all these little fine distinctions in conservative Protestant orbit. And when we finished, I'll never forget, he closed up his pen and he looked at me and said, but let's cut to the real issue. These people are sexually repressed, aren't they? I said, John, they all have six kids. I said, you know, if it's monogamy you have a problem with, then that's another discussion. But I said the best-selling books in the evangelical Protestant community right now are books on sexuality in marriage and how to have a good, fulfilling marriage sexually. Well, this is not the answer he wanted. He was not pleased. He wanted me to say, yeah, really the issue. They're involved in politics because they're sexually repressed. No, that's not what he wanted. And again, that was another indicator to me. This is a man who everybody who reads Powerline would know. He's a political historian. He's a political writer. He's very smart. And he didn't have a clue as to this world. And, in fact, that 1 hour with me was probably the most he'd ever heard theologically about conservative Protestants in America and why they were involved in politics. And he wanted to say, well, they're just involved in politics because some sort of deep Freudian sexual repressions that get them involved and stirred up about American politics. And I wasn't having it. I was hoping in the piece he'd quote me on that, but he didn't.
Well, as we say these days, it didn't fit the narrative. Right?
It did not fit. It did not fit the narrative at all.
Yeah.
But that's why Faith Angle was formed, is to help really smart reporters. This is a world that's totally unfamiliar to them. And And Steve, I think it works is because the journalists have come to trust that I'm not trying to push an agenda on them. I'm trying to actually help them do their job better. And they come away saying, you know, I've got 12 pages of notes. I have new sources, new scholars to call, and I've learned a lot. And very rarely, I can only think of one instance where anybody's really gotten out of hand and upset about what we were discussing. It's serious and sober, and they're smart people. It's a nice venue. Everybody's relaxed. And as Jeffrey Goldberg from The Atlantic said to me once, you know, nobody else in the world is doing this, where you actually have someone like our friend Byron York in dialogue with Wendy Kaminer, then at the American Prospect, in dialogue with Pastor Rick Warren. He said, this is not happening anywhere in the world. And I said, thank you. Would you go tell my funders that? And he did.
Every once in a while, you do hear an editor or a publisher ask, how many evangelicals do you have in your newsroom? And it's always kind of an embarrassing moment. I remember, you know, ABC tried, 20 years ago? Was it Peggy Waymire? Was
yes,
that an
exactly, Iyer? Yes, from Dallas.
And but otherwise, you know, most newsrooms, they're for diversity, except not, they don't ever seem to get around to that kind of diversity.
No, I actually have a true story to tell you about this. The great Mike Allen of Politico, Politico is also an evangelical Christian. He was at the Washington Post, and he was leaving the Post. And literally, and I will not mention the writer's name, said, I want to take you to lunch. I said, okay, we'll go to lunch. He said, we're losing our evangelical. Do you know an evangelical we could hire at the Post? And that's a true story. I mean, I could tell you the guy's name, you'd recognize it. And he said, our evangelical's leaving. I said, oh, who's that? He said, Mike Allen. We need to find another one. And I said, can you recommend? I said, well, there's all kinds of writers out there in religious, in the religion world and Christianity Day magazine, all these places. I said, I'd be glad to give you some names.
Right.
But it was like, we lost one. Can you help us find one?
Yeah, one. Okay. It's like conservatives on college.
So there's some in the now, but it's not a part of the affirmative action program.
Talk to me a minute about David Gregory. I know you spent quite a lot of time talking with him after NBC unceremoniously dumped him from Meet the Press.
Yes, I heard from my friends Jeff Goldberg and David Brooks that David was deeply concerned about religious issues and on his own personal search and writing a book about it, and I should invite him to Faith Angle. I said, well, I can invite him, but you know, he's on TV on Sunday mornings. I don't know if he can get away. And he said he could leave that because Faith Angle begins on Sunday nights. And so he was writing this book titled How's Your Faith? And so we invited him to Faith Angle. 2 weeks later, he was fired from NBC. And I called his assistant up and I said, will David still come? Oh, yeah, he wants to come. I said, well, how will I identify him when we do the list of participants? And she said, I don't know. I said, we listed him as David Gregory journalist because he was literally let go. And it was devastating to him. He knew the rumors were coming. But we got together several times before the conference and afterwards, and he wanted me to read some chapters from his book, and I did, and we talked about it. David was very honest in the fact that he wanted to talk to everybody from various faith traditions. And so we got him a meeting with Tim Keller, the pastor in New York from Presbyterian Church. And he had a chapter on evangelicals in the book, and he wanted me to look at that and several others. And so we had lunch about three times to talk about the book, and it's a very good book. And what he does in the book is he tries to revisit his own childhood and his own Jewish faith, and he does. But in looking at his own Jewish faith, he looks at other traditions very honestly and openly. And basically says to everybody in those traditions, we all should go back and re-examine these questions. So it's a very good book that way.
Right.
And he's very honest and vulnerable about how humbled he was by what happened to him at NBC and about his own relationship to his mom. And it's just a very honest. And he said, you know, my whole experience has been very humbling to me, and so I've had to learn about what the word humility means theologically and religiously because I've just experienced it. I see now that he's back with CNN.
Oh, I admit I don't watch CNN much, I have to say.
I don't either, but he's a commentator for them now.
Let's get out here and conclude with a little bit of fun. You went to Calvin College.
Covenant College.
Covenant College, sorry.
Near Chattanooga, Lookout Mountain, Georgia.
Oh, okay.
Right on top of Lookout Mountain.
Where you were the demon point guard for the basketball team.
Well, that's what my kids think. I was mainly on the bench.
Well, I've seen you play a couple times.
Yes, I was a backup to the point guard.
But More Fun is, and I never actually asked you how this came about, More Fun is you were the mascot for the Philadelphia 76ers. Right.
Yes, that happened.
And what's the name of that mascot?
You're Hoops.
Hoops, and that's a chicken suit or
chicken roadrunner type of character.
Run around the court. And
oh, absolutely. Dancing to music. And
is there any old YouTube footage of this?
This was 1981, so I think it was a little pre-YouTube.
Could be.
I'd love to find it if I could.
How did that come about? I've never thought to ask.
Steve, I worked when I got out of college for 4 years with the famous Chuck Colson and his prison ministry, and there was a movie about Chuck called Born Again. One of the worst movies in the history of cinema. Dean Jones played Chuck Colson. The movie you can find anywhere, and it's not very well done. But we were having premieres around the country, and I sat next in Philadelphia to the general manager of the Philadelphia 76ers, Pat Williams. And he found out about my interest in basketball, and he liked my sense of humor. And they said, we need a new mascot. And he and his wife were talking at the time. They said, you know, Mike Cromartie knows the game, and he seems to be an outgoing kind of guy. So they called me up, and I was in graduate school at American University at the time, and we want to know if you'd consider being the mascot, but you need to go to New York and be interviewed by the people who made the Saturday morning costumes of, the Saturday morning, not the Muppets, but the Sesame Street.
Ah, right.
Sesame Street. They're the ones that make that, and they're going to make our costume, but you have to go be interviewed by them. So I went to New York for the interview. And they said, why do you think you can do this? I said, well, I've been on entertainment with a group called Young Life, and I can do stand-up and all this. And they said, well, you have to understand, in a costume, you don't talk. This is all pantomime. In other words, you're in a costume, and you're not telling jokes. You're running around. I said, I can run around, and I can dance. And they said, show us. And, I mean, I had to say, look, I can.
I did some moves
for them, and the next thing I know, they're measuring my arms and fitting me for a costume. And in the studios of where they made these costumes. And so, I would commute to Philadelphia to home games at the Spectrum back in the day of Dr. Julius Erving and Daryl Dawkins and
Lloyd Free. Did he play with them?
Lloyd B. Free.
Lloyd B. Free, right.
Yes, and Maurice Cheeks and Andrew Toney and Bobby Jones and Caldwell Jones. It was back during the Bird Erving era, 1981. I was in grad school at American University on Tuesday. Home games were on Tuesday nights. I had a class on Tuesday night. I went to my professor. I'm going to have to miss six classes. He said, why? I said, because I'm the mascot for that. He said, that's a great excuse. We'll get you the notes.
Right. And, I mean, those jobs don't pay very much.
$150 at the time was a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, for a graduate student, that's actually more than I thought it might be.
Yeah. And I got to meet some of my heroes, which were these great basketball players.
Oh,
it was huge. I loved it.
Mike Cromartie, you've been doing great work for years and years now, and thanks for joining us on Powerline.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be here.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.